My name is Shannon Jackson. I'm from the University of California, Berkeley. And in the sophomore program, we have assembled a really terrific panel of members of our wider University of California system, both faculty and graduate students here, representing three campuses of what is actually a 10-campus system across the state of California, itself a university system inside of a larger system of higher education in California that includes dozens of state colleges and community colleges as well. And what we wanted to share with you today, first of all, I do want to thank the central organizers of the panel, Charlotte MacGyver and Shane Boyle, for getting us going, and a number of people who jumped in and for allowing me to be your moderator. What we hope to share today is a range of experiences, questions, deliberations, and historical events that unfolded over the last year when, like many other institutions of higher education across the world, the University of California system, about a year ago this week, found out that it was going to be the recipient of an enormous, unexpected budget cut. Which translated to the UC system of about $800 million of expected public money that did not come through for this last fiscal year. So the dramatic development and the emergency state in which the university went into in order to absorb these cuts, as well as the processes created in order to do that absorption, the ways in which the system began to debate the value of particular kinds of fields and what it meant to be a research university, what it meant to be a public university with a certain kind of teaching mission, all came under debate and prompted a number of very complex conversations, a number of protest actions, rallies and strikes throughout the year that we want to sort of share some of those moments with you in order to think together about what they say about the status of public education. A couple of other things to flag, I think, before we proceed. I think that while this is a unique local site in California, it's, I think, an interesting site, I hope, for PSI for a number of reasons. One, when we speak about at PSI the Americanization, which means the USification of performance studies, and still invoke, even at this conference so far today, still invoke NYU and Northwestern as the two sort of flagship American universities that sustain a performance studies research. One of the things that we might want to flag here is what it means not only to be working in performance studies on the West Coast of the United States, but inside a public institution, which differs from the private institutions of Northwestern and NYU. I think in that way, we share provisionally, only partially, but nevertheless, I think significantly, a certain kind of status that most non-U.S. scholars and students at PSI share, which is most non-U.S. PSI scholars, yet faculty and students are at public universities. So you could say that a few things about what we understand, what often emerges in the discourse of public versus private, at least for us in California this last year, is to understand the public university as something that is sustained through public monies and public grants, keeping tuition low in order to provide access for citizens. A private model, we understanding it to be a model that is less dependent on public monies and more on private philanthropic donation, on higher tuition, and on revenue-generating programs, certificate programs, summer programs, rentals, special master's programs where students pay tuition, et cetera, in order to keep the basic operation of research and teaching going. So you could say, in an odd way, the University of California found itself under threat of being Americanized, since those kinds of privatized models are often what people are referring to when they talk about the threat of Americanization. And then the last thing I think I'd want to say that I understand to be a difference and might seem sort of exotic to people from outside of the United States is to flag the kind of federalism under which our public universities operate, which is to say that we have we are a public institution in a country that has a very ambivalent relationship to public institutions and a very strong state rights, state autonomy model, which is to say that taxes are collected within the California and governance models within California are sort of how we are run. So when Aaron Hurley was referring to Canada, talking about the kind of redistributive model at the federal level that compensates for the fact that certain provinces might not have the economic base to keep certain institutions going, that there's a federal, we don't have that kind of federal oversight or redistribution. So when you hear things like in-state, out-of-state, those are actually real flags for us, because in many ways the in-state, out-of-state is also sort of an index of privatization for us as well. Okay. So with that, I'd like to introduce our first speaker. We're going to have each speak for around 7 to 10 minutes about a different dimension of the UC situation, but in every case also making its relevance to some larger international conversations clear. First of all, Shane Boyle, who is a graduate student at UC Berkeley. His talk title is Criminals, Not Activists. And Shane is about to embark on his fifth year as a graduate student at UC Berkeley and will be working in Germany on, what did we decide ultimately? Two fellowships for next year that he received. We didn't write it here, but I'm going to say that he's been the recipient of both an SSRC fellowship and a Fulbright fellowship for his incredible dissertation research on performance and violence as tactics of the German New Left. The title of his dissertation, incidentally, is Playing with Authority, Performance and Provocation of the German New Left, and I think you see some aspects of his research there inflecting how he talks about the UC crisis here.
Okay. Shane? Thank you, Shannon. I have a lot to talk about, but I'm going to stay under 10 minutes and I'll wrap it up whenever I need to. I'm going to be firm on myself, but please also be firm on me with this. I should start by saying that, I can't imagine any of us are neutral on this topic, and I myself certainly am not neutral, so please keep that in mind as you, in the following comments. They're fairly tendentious, but I'm also going to try to situate not only the struggle over education, not only in California, but as a way to start the panel, I'm also going to look at it from kind of a more international dynamic as well. I'm not going to try to lay out some of the similarities, some of the differences, although address some of them, but more as a way to start getting us thinking about this very, 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 very real struggle that many of us are engaged in, not only in California, not only in the U.S., not only in North America, but literally around the world on six continents. Something that is fairly unprecedented, and something that we really, really need to take seriously and bring the rigor that we often apply to our own objects and our own research to these very, very real world problems that affect our own lives and that will for sure affect generations to come. So the title of my talk is Criminals, Not Activists. The second part is, or when legitimate protest is not enough. The title, the first part, Criminals and Activists, comes from a quote from Chancellor Robert Bourgeonnel, Chancellor of UC Berkeley, a statement that he issued on the morning of December 12th following a protest the night before in which dozens of students went to his house, staged a protest, and a few, it's kind of uncertain how many, decided to engage in property destruction by breaking pots. A planter was even thrown at a window. The window did not break because it's shatterproof. And it's sort of an event that, is a pretty watershed moment, not only in the education movement at Berkeley or in California, but I think worldwide, because it was one of the real first acts of violence, and it signaled a lot of... It brought up a lot of really difficult things that I'm sure we can talk about today, so I'm not going to give my opinion too much on that, but maybe we can talk about that. The quote from Robert Bourgeois actually was, "These are criminals, not activists," referring specifically to the people that were engaging in the protest. But it's an extreme quote from an extreme moment, I think. But it's also reflective of a general discourse of criminality that has emerged around certain sectors of the movement in California, but not just in California, but it's a certain discourse that also has emerged and engulfed certain tactics, certain positions, certain political ideologies in various movements across the world, not just in California, one that we need to be aware of. This discourse of criminality is one that's hardly innocuous or even descriptive, but we need to think seriously about how it serves to legitimate, A, the criminalization of protest, and how it will assuredly continue to legitimate the criminalization of protest, maybe not just occupations, property destruction, but perhaps even other forms of protest. And we also need to really think critically about how this discourse of criminality serves to alienate or perhaps even discriminate against certain political positions. A lot of people that engage in more militant tactics, this is not necessarily adventurism, as some have called it. People that engage in militant tactics, at least in California, oftentimes they've been described as white males, and this is a young white male thing. It's adventurous, but the demographics of the people who are actually participating in occupations, sit-ins, blockades, walking onto freeways and stopping traffic in the Bay Area, it's fairly diverse, and in a lot of ways reflective of the composition of students as well. Something that often gets missed in the media hysteria around some of these actions. So I'm interested in this discourse of criminality that surrounds these actions, not just to talk about repression of protests, but also to talk about alternative and diverse tactics. But more importantly, for us to think about the international dynamics of the education movement or movements. Because one thing that seems common, in addition to what a lot of students, faculty, workers are fighting against, in addition to what they're fighting against and fighting for, are the tactics that they're being used. And I personally think that analyzing the tactics and why they're being used at this moment can help us to understand, again, some of the international dynamics of what's going on. I think it's, as performance studies scholars, it's really important to think about more militant tactics, the use of direct action, the use of provocation. And I think as performance studies scholars, we have a lot to offer, not only in terms of thinking critically about solidarity that we have with one another. For example, these things are happening all over the world. For example, where PSI was held last year in Zagreb, I'm not sure if many of you have heard, but this past, I believe, Wednesday, students from Zagreb University, along with some faculty, interrupted a Senate meeting in which they were voting to raise fee hikes. They went into the room, disrupted the meeting, they brought media with them. The Senate meeting could not happen, and they had to disband. They couldn't vote on fee hikes, and instead the students and faculty held an alternative press conference. So, just in that way, this resonates really, really strongly with PSI, I believe. As performance studies scholars, we also, I believe, have the skills that we have as researchers, the methods that we use, the objects that we tend to focus on make us particularly well-positioned to analyze critique tactics that oftentimes criminalize, that are oftentimes talked about in criminal, in ways that are criminal. As performance studies scholars, I think we can use our skills to critique the media discourse that comes out of certain tactics, certain attempts to delegitimate protest. We can also think critically about the ways in which people talk about either praising these tactics, either celebrating them, or condemning them. I think we're particularly we're particularly capable to analyze that. Also, in performance studies, we oftentimes focus on symbolic acts. So to think about the necessity of these types of tactics, occupations, sit-ins, even perhaps certain forms of violence. I know that's a very, very controversial and contentious issue, but something that I think we need to deal with as well. So to think about these things in symbolic terms. Also, you know, here in performance space, we talk a lot about embodiment and subjectivity, and something that's often ignored in talking about provocation, even violence, is the subjective aspects of actually participating or being, you know, on the other end of provocation or violence or militant action. I have a crazy theory that's not really my theory. I don't think it's actually very crazy. But, you know, that it's important to pay attention to the subjective dimensions of taking part not only in protest, but taking part in an occupation. Because, you know, oftentimes this is something that's hardly talked about. It's talked about in terms of media. But I personally believe that certain actions are not just expressive of political beliefs, political sentiments that we have a priori, but, you know, actually taking action can be constitutive of what you believe, what you want, of your political subjectivity. And I think as performance space scholars, that's something that we can really, really add to this discussion. And also, as artists and as performance studies, people who oftentimes engage in performance as well, there's a lot that we can do to think of alternative ways to protest what's going on. Also, you know, alternative ways to fight repression of dissent, to fight the criminalization of dissent. I think, you know, we can use our very creative minds to do this. And at Berkeley, you know, a lot of students, a lot of faculty, you know, use performance, use art to do just this, and to fairly effective ends, I hope. Okay, so I'm about, you know, halfway done with my time, and about an eighth through what I wanted to talk about today. So I'm going to open it up to thinking about the movement in terms of its internationality. Okay, there's a movement that's literally growing around the world on the issue of education. Okay, some people date it to about 2 years ago for one of the first International Days of Action. The fall of 2008. It was an action in November that was organized by this platform called the International Student Movement. I hate that name, International Student Movement, but that's what was there, and that's kind of what's stuck. And it's a platform online, emancipatingeducationforall.org is the website. And they've organized a number of days and weeks of actions over the past 2 years. One that's upcoming is on June 16th, in which Europe and a couple of countries in North Africa and in Japan, I believe, are taking part in this National Day of Action. But the big one is in October, from October till November. They're calling it a global wave of action, in which UC Berkeley and the University of California will also be taking part in. October 7th, I believe, is the next big day of action in California. The movement that's growing, it often takes as its focus higher education, post-secondary education, but it also includes high school students and elementary teachers as well. And this is not just in California, but also worldwide. And it deals, you know, there are a lot of problems in talking about an education movement. Because, you know, we really need to think about why it's an education movement, not a student movement. One of the things is that, you know, it includes more than just students, but faculty in the UC, union workers are a huge part, even alumni and community members. But, you know, also education is, in my opinion, it's when a society has reached a certain level of accumulation of capital, you know, it becomes, education should, you know, it's almost, it seems like it should be a right rather than a privilege, especially when a society can afford it. Even when society cannot necessarily afford it, you know, it should be a priority. That's something that's common. But, you know, there's some problems to deal with that come up with thinking about movements around education, because, you know, one thing that I'm particularly concerned about is, you know, oftentimes it's framed as if, you know, we give more money for education. That means, you know, you look at a budget spreadsheet, that means, you know, some money has to, oftentimes, at least in California, you know, money gets taken away from other services. And that's a problem that we really, really need to deal with. And oftentimes, in California at least, education is seen as an investment in the state, and that's how it's talked about. And so there's a problem in, you know, wanting to invest in the state and things that will give a return, but, you know, other programs that might not necessarily make money, you know, get lost in the shuffle. And just to, like, begin concluding, because I'm about out of time, it's really important that, you know, the movements that are happening, they're hardly homogenous. They're happening from the U.S. to Argentina to Sierra Leone to Greece to England to Iran to Indonesia to Japan. Similar tactics have been used around the globe. Occupations are one of the most common, actually. And so while it's hardly homogenous, we cannot lose sight of the similarities. It's hardly a coincidence that this stuff is happening all around the world. And importantly, oftentimes when we talk about the similarities, people refer to the financial crisis, that this is the reason why things are happening. But we need to really think about why this is a coincidence, and why it's a coincidence beyond just saying, oh, it's a result of the financial crisis. This is something that in California we've been very good, I think, about reflecting on and, you know, really situate within, you know, the history of California, some policy decisions that were made going back to Prop 13 in the late 70s, and really thinking of it in structural terms. And, you know, in Germany and Europe, Germany is another place I'm very familiar with. Germany and Europe, you know, they've also been very effective at reflecting on, you know, it's not just the financial crisis, but actually going back to, you know, issues about the EU, particularly about the Bologna process, which started about 10 years ago, in which they reformed the education system in a way to more reflect, you know, the American, perhaps even in some ways the British model. So those are just some things that I wanted to get us thinking about, and I think now we'll probably focus a lot more on, you know, some of the more specificities of California. So thank you.
Thank you. Suk Young Kim is an associate professor of theater at the University of California at Santa Barbara. She's the author of Elusive Utopia, Theater, Film, and Everyday Performance in North Korea from Michigan Press, which just came out this year, which explores how the state-produced propaganda performances intersect with everyday life practice in North Korea. She is also the co-author with Kim Young of The Long Road Home, a testimony of a North Korean camp survivor from Columbia Press 2009. Currently, she's working on several projects, including Nikolai Gogol's usage of Ukrainian folklore in his short stories, border crossings between two Koreas, and Korean TV dramas and the globalization of Asian media.
Thank you. The crisis is too immense, and I have limited time, so I'm going to focus on the issues that I really personally feel that need to be addressed based on my personal history as well as its implications in larger public education. I spent most of my adult life in foreign lands as international student and then as a foreign faculty member. And I really understand firsthand how important it is for every college student to have a chance to go outside of their comfort zone and explore the world, not only in this neoliberal sense, but I think that kind of chance really creates them to be responsible global citizens and understand the disparity that exists in global economy, as well as America's role in creating so many histories of modern nation states. So if I were president, I think I would make every college student go to these, you know, participate in these education abroad programs and really learn through their life experience the world history and our responsibility in this given moment. And unfortunately, with the crisis, University of California System's education abroad program was attacked as one of the cost-cutting measures, so which I think is very tragic. And I will address some of the issues and what will happen next and what we need to do to address this issue. And not only it is important to send our students to see the world as it's evolving presently, but I think it's also important to increase diversity on our campuses, not only in terms of race, gender, but also in terms of class background and nationalities. And in that sense, I think the treatment of undocumented students is also something that is part of this larger crisis. And it's also an issue that relates to the diversity of how we educate our students. So that'll be my second agenda. If I have more time, I would like to relate that to the larger issues of how we articulate college students as a very crucial constituent of public life. But I'll have time to get to that. UC Education Abroad program has really been an envy of many public educations, not only public education institutions, but really across the United States and the world. So it has benefited many participants over the 50 years of history. And I took this information straight out of their University of California Education Abroad website. So the program has existed since 1962 and served over 60,000 UC students, and approximately 550 faculty members have served EAP. And I myself was very much looking forward to participating in this project, but I don't know if that will be allowed given the financial crisis. And not only did our students go abroad, but also through the reciprocal exchange program, any hosting institutions abroad could send their students to UC campuses and also take advantage of this opportunity for exchange and conversation. So currently, over 30 countries participate in the EKA program, and nearly 250 programs are actively run. But that might easily turn into history. Okay, my PowerPoint has been a little bit messed up, but you can pretty much read that the university president's office declared this new five-year plan as to how they will cut the budget for EPA in the next 5 years. So currently, the subsidy that comes from the president's office, which really goes into kind of supplementing the student fees and cost of living for many students who otherwise cannot afford, will be drastically cut into quarter of the size. So currently the budget is about $4.1 million, and in 5 years it will drop to the level of $1.3 million. So the size is dwindling drastically. And speaking from students' perspective, this means that if you were to go to a country where the cost of living and tuition is higher, then you need to pay more out of your pocket. Whereas currently, the student fee for EAP is somewhat streamlined. So no matter which region you choose to go, the actual amount the student has to pay is somewhat equal. So whether you go to Asia or Africa or Europe or North America, the actual amount that you pay will be streamlined because the subsidy would help kind of make up for that gap. But that would no longer be the case if this were to be really implemented. Also, another implication of this budget cut is that it looks like those who can afford the cost of going abroad can now only participate. And people who really need access to, you know, the president's office subsidy will no longer have it. So the economic stratification of who can afford it and who cannot, and who gets included and excluded, will be much more visible in the future, which is really a dangerous thing in my view. Together with this budget cuts, looks like the president's office is also implementing business model to run EAP as some kind of money-making operation. So here is a quote from the vice provost for academic planning program and coordination saying that switching to business model will make EPA a better program. And I really want to ask how that will take place. First of all, I thought that I was in education, public education, not in business, and so are students. And this is not only a rhetorical device to really declare that there will be switching EAP, but actually for the first time in 50 years of history of EAP at UC, there will be a director who is not a PhD, but MBA, to actually run the program, transform the program as kind of cost-saving measures and also eventually turn it into money-making measures. I mean, I can't predict what it will look like 5 years from now on, but I can imagine that probably the program will bring in foreign students who can afford and pay high tuition and bring more income to UC. I think that might be the direction that it will turn into, and that will kind of dwindle the opportunity for UC students to go abroad as a result. So that's kind of outward movement in terms of the crisis in increasing diversity in our education. But let's think about the kind of inward centripetal movement as to how we can increase diversity at our home front. And this issue, I think, concerns undocumented students and how they will be impacted by the whole crisis. Currently, if you look at their tuition and financial aid package, it looks like this. Undocumented students, and by undocumented students, I mean those who have attended at least 3 years of high school in California and graduated from California high school, even though they might not have the proper documentation. And they are categorized as AB 540 students in legal terms. But anyway, they are eligible for in-state tuition, which helps them to a great degree in having access to public education. But they are not eligible for financial aid. And what happens with their tuition and fee is that every UC student's tuition and fee, and 33% of the tuition and fee that every UC student pays goes to financial aid pool that everyone can tap into, except for undocumented students. So they're actually contributing to creating this financial aid pool for others to take advantage, but they're not eligible for any of that themselves. This used to be different in the past. Undocumented students used to have access to financial aid pool until the federal law overturned that and banned public access, public benefits for undocumented citizens. And I think this should be somehow addressed, and many legislators wanted to kind of pass what they call California Dream Act, which is restoring their access to financial aid, but unfortunately the governor vetoed that bill many times. So that's an issue for me, and I think they should have equal access to financial aid just as much as they're contributing equal in-state tuition for their education. And so how does the future look like for them? One kind of encouraging news for me is that in August when Gould Commission kicked in, is it called UC Commission for the Future?
Yeah.
Yes. After the crisis really seeped in, the president's office initiated this so-called UC Commission for Future, and they organized 5 subcommittees to address the future plans as to how we might survive in the next immediate future and in the long term. And one of the committees is called Access and Affordability, and they address the financial structures of how much students will pay and how it will be distributed, who has access, who has not. And there are some problematic suggestions that were recommended by the commission. But, however, I think that this is a rather positive note that, according to the recommendation by Committee on Access and Affordability, undocumented students are included in the financial aid policy for UC, and it would give them benefits just like the rest of UC students, documented students. However, I should emphasize that the commission's recommendation is just recommendations, and the committee members do not actually have decision-making power at all. I mean, it's more like an advisory board that would generate this intellectual labor that goes to president's office, and I don't know how seriously they would reflect upon the recommendation by commission. So we will have to see, but I think I will really keep my eyes on what will happen to the affordability of these undocumented students. So, do I have some time?
Yeah.
Okay, good. of course, University of California is not only made of students, but I think students play such a crucial role in shaping our future. And I say so because I sort of grew out of the system. I grew up in South Korea, I went to college in South Korea, where practically the democratization of the country from post-colonial state to sort of semi-autonomous democracy that we now have were just spearheaded by students. And I don't say that without any kind of emotion and sentiment, because Oh, I lost all my slides. I was going to show you some student demonstration pictures, but I don't have it. But in any way, the freedom and the benefits that I enjoy are not entirely mine, but they're predicated on their sacrifice that often costs many people's lives. And I do really feel for these young students who took this enormous burden on their shoulders and just pushed forward. And it's really the power of those powerless people that make all these changes. So, very sentimental here. Crisis has done so much damage, but it also is an opportunity to create solidarity and bring us together. So I'd like to emphasize that, it's not only the students, but all these labor, unions on campus and faculty organizations that really came together on September 24th last year in protest against the cuts and created this united front. And I think that crucial link is really the vital point as to how we might play a vital role as a public in shaping the future. So on that note, I will just leave it to Adela.
Thank you. Okay, our next speaker is Charlotte McGulver. I don't have an official bio, but I can say that Charlotte is an amazing graduate student at the Performance Studies program at UC Berkeley, whose research spans both the U.S., but also primarily Irish and South Asian performance. I don't have your dissertation title in front of me, so I'm going to leave it to you to perhaps say.
Okay. Staging the Globalized Irish Race, Gender, and Performance After the Celtic Tiger.
Thank you.
So my talk today is called High-Touched Mixed Economies, Performance Studies, Online Education, and Teaching the Spaces Between Public and Private. What I'm going to be talking about today is UC Berkeley Dean of the School of Law, Christopher Edley's recent proposal for an online UC. I know that many of us sitting in this room have had our own experiences with online education, whether as students or as faculty members, and I look forward to hearing about those experiences in our talk back. What I'm considering today is Edley's proposal in the context of growth in online education and for-profit colleges overall, and thinking about these things in relationship to issues of pedagogy, race, gender, class, and access to education. Ultimately, I want to raise questions about the implications for and place of theater and performance studies within these debates. As Engbeng Lin asked in the most recent theater survey, quote, what is the role of theater and performance in an educative enterprise at the conjuncture of professional, global, and institutional forces that favor profit, economies of scale, practical training, business, and the life sciences? How may non-revenue-generating areas of study, such as performance and theater studies, queer studies, and ethnic studies, continue to push for institutional commitment for alternative forms of expression, agency, and subjectivity? End quote. Indeed, the question of how performance studies will continue to push for recognition of alternative knowledges, pedagogies, and approaches represents a crucial potential area of intervention. Our interdisciplinary expertise in alternative forms of expression, agency, and subjectivity is essential in unpacking, for example, the benefits and liabilities of a move towards online education, as our work remains deeply committed to interrogating issues of presence, performance, and efficacy. However, I am not suggesting here that our knowledges be instrumentalized in the service of fact-gathering and predicting outcomes for university administrations. In the face of massive changes within systems of higher education, theater and performance studies bring powerful methodological and practical tools suitable not only for advocating the survival of the humanities at large, but for serving as crucibles within which the larger issues at hand can be examined. Our mapping of the convergence of these issues can account for both the affective and effective dimensions of these debates, some of what Shane was suggesting as well, and the material economies in which their outcome of things like privatization is staged with the bodies of students, professors, and staff. Today, I focus on the application of this argument to debates around online education and distance learning, but I hope these comments are going to prompt discussion and reflection on other related topics as well. So, on July 1st, 2009, the dean of UC Berkeley School of Law, Christopher Edley, published an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times entitled Building a New UC - Insider Space. Edley argued for the creation of an 11th UC cyber campus in order to, quote, put high quality higher education within the reach of tens of thousands of more students, including part-timers, and eventually provide a revenue boost for higher education, end quote. He presented this idea as an opportunity for the UC to fill a niche in online education untouched by other premier institutions and renew California's commitment to excellence in education. So this new UC is planned to charge the same as tuition to the UC as it stands now, the idea that the savings are in living expenses and, of course, the flexibility of an online system. First, associate degrees will be offered, later bachelor's degrees, and there's been discussion of professional master's programs as well. So, in the months that followed his initial proposal, Edley's rhetoric intensified as he linked the project to his longtime interest in the, quote, racial justice arena. Yet, he also began referring to faculty sympathetic to his project as the, quote, and this is a direct quote, coalition of the willing. This explicitly militaristic euphemism deployed by Edley multiple times was matched by a later claim that, quote, my ambition is global domination, as the online UC system would welcome quality students from Kentucky to Kuala Lumpur. In fall 2010, the UC system hopes to pursue these plans with a $5 to $6 million pilot project. So, in a time of economic collapse, who are the targeted funders? Quote, the university hopes to raise money from external sources like foundations and major donors. Following the UC fee hikes, furloughs, layoffs, and salary hikes for top administrative officials, this move by Edley and the university stands out as another confirmation of the UC system's move towards privatization as a response to economic crisis. Despite Edley's argument that an online UC would increase access to education for all Californians, Associate Professor Christy Boring, chair of the Courses of Instruction Committee of the Berkeley Division of the Academic Senate, observed, quote, that fully involved online courses require a greater investment of time and money than traditional face-to-face classes. She and many of her colleagues, quote, are of the opinion that online but equal will go the way of separate but equal in terms of being an educational failure. Edley's proposed solution for these workload issues is creating an intensified hierarchy of senior faculty members, instructors, and graduate students. He explains, quote, for each course there will be a tenure-track faculty member who will be the course owner. Two, an instructor of record, a lecturer. Three, this is the best part, a squadron of GSI. By the instructor of record, and there's our own Shane Boyle in the middle, dressed as a GSI. So, this arrangement would arguably free up more time for senior faculty member research, but questions of the pedagogical and professional benefits for lecturers and GSIs have not yet been engaged. Edley, in fact, downplays resistance from faculty outside the coalition of the willing, whom he argues, quote, rebel in the comfort of denial and the conservatism of greatness. They're in denial. Edley's language thus vacillates between advocating for racial justice and the perseverance of education in the quality elite sector, and presenting an aggressive business plan for the UC brand based on online education as the only way forward, which alarmingly likens current students to, quote, white mice for the testing of this plan. Mm. The arrogance of his language and blatant disregard for student feedback and faculty feedback and students' experiences weakens claims that these plans intend to deliver high-quality and accessible education first and foremost. Yet, Edley's conflation of issues of education, access, branding, and global domination reflects intensifying pressures on higher education worldwide. Ultimately, the gestating UC cyber campus and Edley's bombastic excesses represent far more than only a threat to the mission of the UC. Rather, these battles within the UC and California at large reflect the changing face of education as for-profit and increasingly globalized in national and international contexts. Thus, despite despite the fact that California ranks 49th in the U.S. in terms of sending its own high school graduates to college, Edley's already looking towards global markets as a source of profit and prestige. The growth of the for-profit education sector was heavily utilized as online education models, as symbolized for the success in the U.S. at the University of Phoenix, among others, seeks to fulfill record demands for higher education, while funding for education at state and national levels continues to depreciate. In order to compete, the UC, among others, must walk a fine line between responding to developments in technology that necessitate innovation in online education and adopting the business models of their for-profit competitors, which may succeed in profit margins but rank their educational mission much lower. However, the debates over private and over higher education are not a simple matter of us performance studies and our related disciplines versus them, the privatizing and corporatized universities. Our inner discipline, which is so insistent on social justice and student-centered pedagogical models, will find that this language is being appropriated by university administrators. So while they raise their fees and expand outwards via the web and satellite campuses abroad, and Englund has a fabulous article on this in a recent social text, administrators use the language of social justice and, quote, innovation in pedagogy and teaching common amongst our own conversations. Edley argues of the UC Cyber Campus that, quote, in a way, it's kind of radical. It's kind of destabilizing the mechanisms by which we produce the elite in our society. Statistically, those availing of the burgeoning for-profit online education sector are non-traditional students, minorities, and women who must work while pursuing higher education. Thus, as the UC system struggles to remain public and continue to serve its students who represent, quote, and this is a quote from an article by Shannon, more low-income students on Pell Grants than all Ivy Leagues combined, how can the needs of our current and future faculty, students, and staff be balanced with not only seeking to preserve public education within California, but to extend its reach in a marketplace where corporatized education is increasingly capitalizing on underserved students? Shannon Jackson insists on, quote, a fundamental recognition of our contingency in which, quote, our sense of the role of arts and humanities in an interdependent social vision will continue to require a complicated sense of the mixed economies in which these worlds are funded. In the face of these mixed economies, theater and performance studies can offer accounts of our tactile contingencies that take place on the terrain of these blended markets of the public and the private. Edley indeed positions the tactile as central to the future success of the online UC. He insists, quote, we must figure out new faculty structures for high-touch systems. The commitment of theater and performance studies to what Jill Dolan names, quote, embodied teaching and learning as a matter of course in studio theory, media, and literature classes puts us in a crucial position to argue, in bell hooks' words, that, quote, teaching is a performative act, and it is that aspect of our work that offers the space for change, invention, spontaneous shifts, that can serve as a catalyst for drawing out the unique elements of each classroom. To embrace the performative aspect of teaching, we are compelled to engage audiences to consider issues of reciprocity. Teaching is meant to serve as a catalyst that calls everyone to become more and more engaged, to become active participants in learning. While proposals to implement online education may increase the number of students enrolled in the UC, it is essential to consider what gets lost in the absence of in-person, high-touch pedagogy. It is no coincidence that students and faculty of color are highly represented amongst those enrolled in or teaching for for-profit online universities. These are the individuals with statistically limited access to higher education, within public or private higher education. However, while many do, of course, benefit from these degrees and employment, it is hard to ignore the lack of tenure jobs for faculty who consequently enjoy limited opportunities for research and advancement in their field, or the reports of mounting debt and lack of instructional quality for many students, as recently explored in PBS's Frontline's controversial special, College Inc., and that's available online. Hence, it seems that instead of truly increasing access, that these models of for-profit and online education may re-entrench existing social inequalities. Professor Burings worries that these plans may go the way of separate but equal and continuing to grant privileged students the access to high-touch on-campus instruction while marginalizing students who cannot pay or make time to attend a traditional university program prove prescient. Dean Edley has repeatedly asserted that the only difference between an online UC and an on-campus instruction is that, and this he said this more than once, quote, our online students might miss the keg parties. Edley's comments make clear that he lacks a fundamental understanding of the potential of high touch lived in real time in immediate proximity to live students. From awkward silences to shared discoveries to tension to excitement to projects and spirited discussion in small and large groups, these immediate, tangible, and tactile experiences form the core of an education, and I think that's something we all deeply believe, just as important as the content delivered. Rather than planning how to replicate and package this experience online, it seems that the UC's energy would be better spent, and universities elsewhere as well, providing access to the university for more lower-income students through reduced fees and more night classes, rather than planning to capitalize on their needs and vulnerability from a distance. It's true that the growth of online education cannot ultimately be resisted. If we do so in the humanities, we risk it being implemented without our input. However, this technological inevitability cannot be privileged as a future of pedagogy as profit. Thank you.
Thank you, Charlotte. Our next speaker is Patrick Anderson, who's an associate professor in the Department of Communication at the University of California, San Diego, where he is also a faculty affiliate of Critical Gender Studies and Ethnic Studies. He is the co-editor with Jisha Menon of Violence Performed, Local Roots and Global Routes of Conflict, and the author of So Much Wasted, Hunger, Performance, and the Morbidity of Resistance, which will be released by Duke University Press this September. Patrick Anderson.
So I'm going to take a slightly different tone, I guess. And I'm doing that for one main reason, which is the following. Throughout the last couple of years, insisted when talking with students or colleagues, either within the UC system or at other public institutions in California or at other public institutions in the U.S., or for that matter, with private institutions in the U.S., and with colleagues who aren't based in the U.S. or North America, that it's probably in our best interest not to talk about this as a budget crisis, but to talk about it as an ethical crisis, in which we are all already implicated and with which we are all already participating, whether we like it or not, whether we know it or not, right? To think too discreetly about something that we label a crisis, as if a new rupture has appeared, narrativizes the event in a way that probably won't be helpful in terms of our historiological understanding of what's going on, and may not be helpful in terms of thinking about the futures that we might begin to imagine differently than we would have imagined them a couple years ago. So I'd like, for the moment, for my 8 or 10 minutes, to insist upon calling this an ethical crisis with budgetary implications, again, in which we are all already participating, whether we like it, whether we know it or not. So I'll start with a little anecdote that I think teases that suggestion out a bit. There's a wonderful, and I'm going to try to talk about this in broader ways, from the perspective of someone who happens to be teaching in the UC system and happens to have done his doctorate in the UC system, but I'm just going to try to bring the language up a couple scales, at least, again, for the next 8 to 10 minutes. So there's a wonderful scholar at UC Riverside, put that aside for a moment, named Dylan Rodriguez. Dylan is a scholar of Filipina and Filipino immigration, an incredible scholar of the prison industrial complex, both in the U.S. and in other locations worldwide, among other things. He was recently promoted to professor and became chair of the Ethnic Studies Department at UC Riverside. So I brought Dylan to UC San Diego to speak a few months ago, and this was maybe 9 months after he had been promoted to full professor and named the chair of what is an extremely vibrant ethnic studies department at UC Riverside. And we were kind of hanging out, you know, before this talk, chatting, and I said, wow, so you just became chair. What a welcome to that role in the midst of, you know, everything going on. How's it going? And he said, well, you know, it's really funny. Everybody's calling this a crisis, but we live under these conditions all the time in ethnic studies. We always live with the threat of closure. We always live with micro-budgets. We've been dealing with these kinds of questions all along, and in fact, they're really a part of our work. So what's happened to us, giving my own tenor to Dylan's voice. What's happened to us at UC Riverside is that our dean is now pointing to ethnic studies as a model for how ethnic studies should be behaving. He said, I've been in chairs meetings where the chairs of mathematics and physics and biology have been told to come talk to me about how ethnic studies does what it does.
Same with theater, just so you know.
Right? So this is my suggestion, that all of the different kinds of departments that Eng Beng writes about in the piece that Charlotte McIver just quoted have something in common. And I'm thinking here about interdisciplinary units, arts practice-based units, and then what I'll generally call social justice organized units, including critical gender studies, women's studies, queer studies, ethnic studies, and so on. We have something in common, which is that we have systems for thinking about how ethical crises become budgetary and how to operate under those conditions. Mm-hmm. Ricardo Dominguez, who's a colleague of mine at UC San Diego, and many of you have probably seen and signed the petition in support of him, has another way of saying this, which is that no matter what it is you're doing, you should always have a high budget plan, a middle budget plan, and a no budget plan. And if you're unable to conceive of what you're doing without those three options, without those three possibilities, then you need to reconceive your relationship to what you're doing, right? Okay, so I begin with all of this not to suggest that we should, that the questions we might begin asking should differ from those that have been proposed already in terms of thinking about the institution as something that needs to be intervened upon, even attacked in different kinds of ways and so on, but rather to think back to the first day of the conference and the first talk of the conference, which was our own Shannon Jackson's talk on, was that Wednesday?
Thursday.
Was it Thursday? Okay, on Thursday. About public support. To echo Shannon's call, what I understood as Shannon's call in that talk, to understand institutional support and public support in ways that allow us to value, right, critically, but to value the very institutions that we're trying to save. It seems to me, participating in the action that's happened both at the faculty level and at the coalitional level between faculty groups, staff groups, and student groups, it seems to me that the vocabulary of resistance comes naturally in moments like this. But it to me, in the context at UCSD and in conversations with others elsewhere, it seems to me that it comes a bit too naturally sometimes, and that we might start to think about resistance complicated by a kind of love, right? What does it mean to resist or attempt to subvert intervene upon an institution that you value in a way that we might characterize as love? With that in mind, I thought I might make some suggestions for the terms through which we might have conversations about what performance studies people in particular can bring to the table at this particular moment. So I'd like to propose, do I have, two or three minutes left?
No, you actually have four.
Four, okay. I'd like to propose what I'll call the three I's of the performance studies, of a possible performance studies vocabulary for engaging in these conversations. And the three I's I'll call the interpretive, the institutional, and the intersubjective, right? Mm-hmm. If these are three modalities through which performance studies, scholarship, and action can act upon conversations and participate in those conversations, then they might, for example, look something like this. So one of the crises from my own institution, which happens to be UC San Diego, but these could be examples from any of a number of institutions across the state, across the country, around the world, the budget crisis was not merely coincidental with, but I think coextensive with, a number of other things happening at UCSD, including the tenure, the threat of revoking tenure from Ricardo Dominguez recently for his work both in activism on campus and for his work with what's called a transporter immigrant tool that's very controversial in Southern California. In addition to Ricardo's situation, at all of the UC campuses, there have been recent incidents, they're calling them, that are characterized variously as racist, misogynist, homophobic, heterosexist, etc. Stagings, including the sort of hanging of a noose in a university library at UCSD, which in a U.S. context it's interesting, this is where the institution understands performativity in a natural kind of way, right? It's not merely descriptive of violence, but the California State Penal Code understands the hanging of a noose as a direct threat of violence upon African-American communities, right? It's a direct threat, just the act of hanging. So the institution already has these languages of performativity that we can help them work through, right? So when, for example, our students or colleagues or whomever, or administrators in the case of some UC campuses, respond by saying, "What's the big deal?" we can help with the interpretive work, the first of those three I's, of explaining the long histories of violence that are summoned by those kinds of images. And again, I see this as a part of the ethical crisis, not just coincident with the budget crisis. In part because these are, you know, the departments that respond to that kind of thing are the ones that are most under threat. So we can involve ourselves in the interpretive work of helping the administration understand what's wrong with that kind of activity and how it does connect to fiscal considerations that the UC is currently examining. Institutionally speaking, incidents like the one I just described can be used to track structural histories within the institution that have to do with recruiting and retaining certain populations. In the case of UC San Diego, we've historically had a disastrous record of being able to attract, in particular, African-American students. Although UCSD is not a majority white campus, its underrepresented minorities are extreme in their underrepresentation. So we can point to administrative and other institutional ways in which the structural basis upon which those incidents can emerge. So that kind of institutional work that invests us in the institution, that strengthens the support that we can build within the context of the institution and so on. And finally, the third eye, the intersubjective eye, involves what Shannon beautifully evoked, I thought, as systems of support. So in a moment when what the California State Penal Code, for example, recognizes as a direct threat of violence, we have to remain attentive to the student populations who feel the most direct threat of violence in that moment, right? So one of the things that's happened at UCSD is an incredible galvanizing of activism, yes, but structures of support, I think, more importantly, right? So that we have found the ways in which we can participate in providing for one another without asking the institution to decide how to provide these kinds of structures of support. But we can create space to find those modes of support and then forge ways of participating with one another and cooperating in making them happen. So those are some suggestions. I think I'm at the end of my time now. Thank you.
Our last speaker is Shannon Steen, who is an associate professor in TDPS, Theater, Dance, and Performance Studies at UC Berkeley, where she is also a faculty member in the American Studies program. Her book, Racial Geometries, The Black Atlantic, The Asian Pacific, and American Performance, was published with Palgrave in January 2010. She is now researching a project on California and the performance of racial location. And she doesn't say it here, but she has been a very active and pivotal member in the solidarity movement, the Save University movement in the University of California. And I think we'll be hearing more about that.
Thank you. So I'm not actually going to be giving an analytical presentation about the crisis of ethics in California, but rather I'm going to talk about specific strategies and tactics that the organizations that I've been involved with have been using in order to try to fight the challenges that we've been going on. And I'm presenting this in what's in the spirit of information sharing, in the hopes that this will help some of you in the institutions that you're working in. And if you have suggestions for us, I would love to hear them, because we can use all the help we can get right now. I'm going to speak primarily to two interlocking problems within what is, I think, the neoliberalization of higher education, this privatization structures that Shanna talked about at the beginning of the session. One of those is diminishing state support, but the second is the administrative policies and priorities that are changing us into this ever more privatized institution. I think it's really important to acknowledge, and Charlotte just did a fabulous job, and Sukyung has also done a fabulous job talking about one element of this, about the ways that one of the really crucial elements of what's happening is the ways that our administrators, especially at the highest levels, are taking a really active part in dismantling the public structures of higher ed, often in the guise of saving them. One more thing that I want to note before I talk about this is that with the situation in California is that when we speak about the Americanization of ex-public structure, in this case higher ed and those dynamics of privatization, we're really in many ways speaking about the Californication of those structures, because a lot of the policies that lead to privatization were actually born and innovated in California. And for all that California has held up within the United States as this kind of whipping boy for the political right with, you know, San Francisco values and all of this kind of stuff that our right politicians get up and sort of grandstand about all the time, California is actually the point of origin for a lot of the policies that the right sort of enshrine and mythologize in the United States. And one of the things that we rightly remember is that a lot of the platforms that they sort of lionize from their current patron saint, Ronald Reagan, were actually created when he was governor of California, which was the job he held before he became president of the U.S. So this is, I think, important to recognize within thinking about what's going on in California. So a bit of background about the groups that I'm involved in. Two of the primary organizations that I'm involved with, and there are many more than this. So two of the organizations that I'm going to talk about, these are primarily Berkeley organizations, although they're now sort of spreading and they have sort of tentacles in other places. One of them is the Solidarity Alliance. Sukyung actually had that great slide where she had these up, which was created just this year to bring all sectors of the university together. And as Sukyung and various people have talked about, this, one of the things that's really stunning about this, and it is historically unprecedented, is the extent to which this is an all-sector organization. So it has faculty involved, but it has students, both undergraduate and graduate students in it. It has workers from various arenas on the campus, everything from librarians to clerical staff to our groundskeepers. It has union reps involved in it. And this organization was kind of the first off the ground this year in many respects, and was responsible for the first wave of public protests that Berkeley witnessed this fall, including the one that happened at the end of September that got a lot of national attention and drew a lot of public attention in the U.S. Partly because it's this kind of all-sector organization, it's a little bit notorious with our administration, which has a really vexed, if not downright hostile, relationship to its unions. And so because of that, the administration really ends up seeing this organization as being driven by the unions, even though that's really not the case. So that's one, is the Solidarity Alliance. The second organization that I'll be talking about is one called Save the University, or SAVE for short, which is a faculty organization that was created also this year and manages very different kinds of work. A lot of it in kind of backdoor meetings with administrators on both the campus and the system-wide level, and increasingly with political figures of various stripes. On the administrative level, we've been trying to work almost as an alternative to our academic senate, which at Berkeley in particular is an institution that is understood by the progressive faculty as kind of a voice box that's this top-down structure of the administration telling the faculty what to do, rather than the other way around, which is nominally what it was constituted to do, which was to voice faculty concerns up to the admin, and it doesn't really seem to be working in that way right now. So SAVE is trying to function as an alternate to that. A couple of other organizations that have been set up on campus that have been really crucial to the work that we've been doing this year is a listserv for the faculty called the Faculty Budget Forum that has served both as a place to have debates about the policies on campus and system-wide, and also just as a clearinghouse for information about policy for various news organizations that have been reporting about what's going on. And it's been kind of a mixed bag, in the sense that it's produced this kind of overwhelming amount of email. And it's also produced some pretty nasty flame wars on campus. So actually, at one point over the winter break last year, it was closed down over the winter break after a particularly nasty fight that broke out around some issues that were only slightly related to anything that was going on with the budget. But it's also been this really amazing exchange of information despite that. So I'm so much better informed about the university in general and how it functions precisely because of this listserv function. So in the whole, I actually think it's been a pretty important tool, even though it's also been contentious. This second organization is the resuscitation of something called the Berkeley Faculty Association, which was specifically originally created as this kind of alternate to the Academic Senate several years ago, and it's being recreated. And so SAVE kind of came online until the Berkeley Faculty Association could really get going. And it's being run now by some pretty interesting people, including Wendy Brown, along with Jillian Hart in geography, and this woman, Christine Rosen, who's actually a progressive member of our business school, and apparently they actually really do have a couple of progressive people in our business school, who've been producing reports that expose all kinds of faulty logic and reasoning and assumptions that the official administrative documents have been circulating on these issues. Having spoken about that, one of the things that I'm going to talk now about what we've been dealing with on the lack of state funding issue front. So what SAFE has been doing on the lack of state funding, although the Solidarity Alliance has been doing as well, is undertaking a kind of systematic campaign to try to educate the general public about the value of the public university. And there are a couple of major strands that we've been dealing with about this for both the general public and also for legislators. One of them has been trying to create this public education campaign on what the benefits of higher ed are for the state. Economically, we've been trying to make the argument about the economic benefits, because one of the problems is that the state has often been seen, or the general public asks, whether or not public education is actually an economic whole for the state, right? That people actually really don't understand even the basic economics of what the benefits are. But some of it has also been talking about what the non-economic benefits are for the state as well. A lot of this has been talking about what the university actually does, because a lot of people really don't understand, and they specifically don't understand the role of research in this, right? They understand the teaching benefits in the sense of people getting degrees and things like that, but they really don't understand the research, and they particularly don't understand the relationship between research and teaching, right? Like how those are mutually informing exercises. The other thing that we've been trying to carry a kind of public information campaign on is the hurdles to financing public higher education in California, which has some really specific manifestations in California, one of which is something called Proposition 13, which was a proposition that was passed in the 70s under the guise of freezing property taxes so that nice old ladies who were on fixed incomes didn't get thrown out of their homes by increasing property taxes as the housing market exploded, but really was a kind of white flight anxiety about not funding education schools for students of color. So it was a way for white people to not fund schools in cities that had large black and Hispanic populations and Latino populations. The second thing that we've been really trying to educate people about is the impact of prison structures on California higher ed. This is huge. So California, I'm not sure how many of you know this, but has this one of the largest prison building and incarceration structures in the world. And because of a law that was passed in the mid-1990s called the Three Strikes Law, we now throw people into prison for life for a whole set of offenses, many of which are nonviolent. And the cost of the Three Strikes Law and this long-term incarceration structure has been astronomical. And when you look at public data charts on where the money, there's this kind of perfect mirror image of the lines on the graphs between the money that has gone into prisons versus the money that has gone into higher ed since Three Strikes has been passed. So this has been really huge, trying to like educate the public on this. And there are several different tactics that we've been using about this. Some of these are these coordinated statewide public rallies that have been getting quite a bit of media support. But some of it has also been this kind of media campaign where we've done things like put together a press group that we do outside of the normal PR structures of the university, which have basically done a very poor job of making this these arguments public, both because they just don't seem to be terribly effective. They're actually drawing interviews and op-eds and things like that, but also because they've had the wrong message very frequently. Chris Newfield, who has been doing fantastic work, he's a political scientist at Santa Cruz. Is he in English? Oh, I thought he was in Polish. Okay. Who's been doing this fantastic work thinking about this. He actually has a blog that I highly recommend reading that talks about all kinds of problems within the UC system that are applicable to many other places. Has talked about how in the latest round of budgetary structures, one of the things the UC has said, look at how much money we've cut. We've cut all this money. We've cut all this money. But he says one of the things, he points out that one of the things that those kind of arguments do is that they actually reinforce a message that there's waste in public education that could be cut, right? So it's actually reinforcing a kind of neoliberal argument that actually there's money that we can be taking out of higher ed without actually harming it. So we've been trying to actually create a kind of counter-narrative to that work. One of the things that's been really helpful with this is we actually created a press kit that we send out to like every media organization we can get a hold of. We have tried to put together a list of media contacts that faculty in various areas have. We've just been inundating them with press releases, with information, with talking points, with historical background on things like policy to try to create this counter narrative to what our own PR institutions are doing. Some of what has been really helpful with this is getting help from George Lakoff, who's the linguist who works on all these ideas of the framing of public arguments. He was actually great with sitting down with us and just helping us work, hammer out what those talking points should be. If anybody wants those talking points, I'm quite happy to like share any of that information. Just send me an email and I'll shoot you our press packets. One of the other things that we've tried to do is create video testimonials for distribution, especially to legislators, where we have students and faculty talking about the value of higher education in their own lives. A lot of this has been work where we've had students who are first generation talking about the ways that the UC is giving them certain kinds of opportunities that they just wouldn't have either for themselves or their families or the communities, and the way that the new budgetary structures are actually imperiling all of those opportunities. And we've been sending those to legislators in right now as the California state budget is being debated for next year, so they're trying to figure out how much money they're going to give to us for next year around this. Part of this work has been also working on legislators. Where are we on time? One of the other, so I'll actually skip to some of the problems we've been working on the inside of the university. One of the things we've been doing is really trying to fight this commission of the future that Suk Young was talking about. And this is really key because the commission has come up with all kinds of really problematic issues. Just to put this in another term, to talk to some of the issues that Patrick had spoken about, one of the things the administration has really done is absorb this kind of classic shock doctrine orientation. So this is like straight out of Naomi Klein's sort of analysis of how one of the things that has happened is that the language of the crisis is created and used in order to push through a series of privatization dynamics, right? And that's exactly what we're seeing even inside of our own administration. So one of the things that the administration has done in this Commission of the Future is to create a series of numbers that are really, it's really hard to track whether or not those numbers are accurate and where the numbers are coming from. So one of the things they've told us in this Commission of the Future is that by the year 2019, that the UC system will be $5 billion in the red. But they've been extremely elusive about explaining what is actually causing this shortfall. So it's really hard for us to fight back and say what is going on with what's happening. And they're using those numbers to actually put through all of these changes that we're seeing around tuition hikes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they're being really underhanded about how they calculate some of the numbers on their data for those recommendations. So this affordability working group that Sookyung was talking about, that's thinking about precisely the problems of student debt loads and things like that, use this really underhanded calculation tactic to figure out things like average student debt loads, where they would say, okay, so the average student debt load for the University of California is only $15,000. But in order to calculate that, they included all of the students who are walking out with no debt into that number. So that it turns out that actually the average student debt is actually twice that high when you look at the students who are actually leaving school with debt. So it's more like $30,000 a year. And they're using that to say, well, that's not that much money, and so therefore we can actually increase our tuition. So one of the things that the faculty groups that I've been involved with are trying to do is actually force them to use more honest calculation methods and going back to the commission and saying, this is really not appropriate. We have to use better methods so that we actually have an accurate sense of what's going on. The other thing that we've been doing is actually trying to have these kind of backdoor meetings with both the president of the UC system and some of our regents to try to enforce these things through. So we've actually been asking for private meetings with our higher administrations. They've so far been doing it. And one of the things we've really noticed is that they respond much better to specific stories about how the proposed changes are actually stopping us from being able to do our jobs than they do to more abstract arguments about things like privatization. So when we come back and say, you know, privatization is a problem because of X, Y, and Z, they ignore us. When we come back and we say, look, this policy is actually forcing a third of the students out of my classroom. It's stopping me from being able to do this thing when I teach. It's actually making me consider getting a job at another university because now I feel like the work that the UC system does is now tainted and doesn't mean the same thing that it used to, then they listen. So use specific stories when dealing with administrators and not big abstract arguments. So I'll just stop there.
We have some minutes for questions. I think I'll open it immediately to any questions or comments or that might.
Yeah. Thank you, everyone. I'm interested in kind of asking Patrick to talk a little bit more specifically about how, say, the kinds of the problematics that Shane brought up about, you know, the necessity of non-legitimate protests in certain situations might actually be part of a kind of lawless strategy, that they're actually not, because it sounded like a little bit like they were opposed to one another in line somehow, and I wondered if, you know, if you could talk a little bit more specifically about how you're thinking about, you know, about the protest actions in relation to a more supportive model of enabling the institution to continue.
Yeah, I'm not sure that they're diametrically opposed in my mind. I guess one of the things, you know, at UCSD we have a very different activist landscape and history than the one at Berkeley. And what's different is not that Berkeley has it and UCSD doesn't. It's that Berkeley stages itself as having it in a particular way and UCSD doesn't stage itself as having it in a certain way. But the history of UCSD as an activist institution is long and thick. Angela Davis and Herb Marcuse basically founded my department in the late 60s and early 70s. The Burning Man was a rebel college student at UCSD who set himself on fire in protest of the Vietnam War. So Burning Man, for those of you who are aware of that festival, is connected to UCSD activism. The campus has been designed in such a way to respond to student activism, so we have these mounds all over campus, as you know, that so you can't assemble and see very many people in any one place. So we have a history, and we occupy the chancellor's office. The students do whenever we have an opportunity to do that. And the administration actually welcomes that kind of thing in a strange way, right? So there's not the same antagonism between the riot gear and the students every time a group of students go into the chancellor's office. So there's just a different activist context at UCSD. I guess I've been more and more thinking about this from a pedagogical perspective, because if it's true, and I think it is, I think we all think it is, or at least we're telling ourselves that it is, that this ethical crisis that has severe budget implications will trickle down to our students and will give our students less, right? If it'll equip them in fewer and fewer ways with fewer and fewer skills, right? Then, of course, we need to think about this as an opportunity to equip them more and more in participating in institutions critically and in engaged ways, right? So I've come to think about it in pedagogical ways. And I'll just very quickly say that, so one of the things I did was to take a senior, an advanced upper level undergraduate seminar that typically is a very traditional seminar with heavy reading, heavy writing, sitting around a table like this discussing activism, say, and so on, and I turned it into a performance studies class, which went so well that my department, which is in the social sciences, is thinking of modeling the senior seminars after the performance studies version of that class. And the students came into the room, I would say maybe 60% of them would have claimed activism, 50 or 60% coming in, but activism in a certain model. They came in, bring down the regents, tear down the buildings, set everything on fire. And we staged a number of what I called interventions, including that was based on deep archival research, where they went into the archives, looked at the numbers, counted, and the four assignments I gave them. And so they left with love for the institution, a critical love, right? A very different response than what they'd come in with. But the four assignments were, we got a 600 square foot wall in the heart of the department that they painted a massive public access mural on, tracing the history of student activism from the mid-19th century to the present. They did a William Popel-inspired crawl across Library Walk for an hour, inscribing the narratives of people affected by the crisis in chalk on the sidewalk, which drew a huge amount of press and prompted another group to make a documentary about the chalk walk, as we're calling it. They staged other sort of more micro interventions in small groups. And then the last assignment, which I'll have in a stack when we get back, is that they've written student-centered suggestions for the regents on how to respond to the budget part of the crisis with students in mind. And this has changed their involvement.